From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, he led the LA Phil, won Oscars and Grammys. We discuss the life of Andre Previn. Then actor Chiwetel Ejiofor directs his first feature. It's about the inventor William Kamkwamba, the boy who harnessed the wind.
I think if I could pinpoint the moment where I was completely sold, that I just was like, I have to try and tell this story, was actually a description of William Kamkwamba sneaking into school.
And choral students from Van Nuys High School collaborate with the LA Master Chorale. All that coming up on The Frame. People who have been attending concerts by the LA Phil for a while know the name Andre Previn. He led the orchestra from 1985 to 1989 before Esa-Pekka Salonen took over as its music director. But Previn, who died in New York today at the age of 89, did far more than carry a baton. Like Leonard Bernstein, to whom Previn has been favorably compared, Previn wrote movie scores, played piano, and composed both operas and Broadway musicals. I asked Zachary Wolf, the classical music editor at the New York Times, to weigh in on Previn's eclectic musical career.
Only really kind of Leonard Bernstein comes to mind as a sort of parallel in terms of one of these mid-century Americans who, as sort of classical music achieved this unbelievably wide audience through recordings and the rise of jazz, musical theater, film, I mean, everything kind of sort of collided and made this sort of explosion coming out of the U.S. And there were a couple of people who had the versatility and the talent, and Previn was definitely one of them.
I want to play Andre Previn playing piano for a piece called Just in Time. Let's listen to it. So how did his work in jazz and film scoring make him a different conductor when he was with the baton?
The read on him, and I agree with, was that there was always a kind of amazing sense of spontaneity and rhythm and a lot of poise. And, I mean, he did wonderful recordings of French music. I mean, and this was not stuff necessarily that was jazzy per se, but I think that there must have been, I think, a taste for rhythmic flair and for certain spirit and vitality throughout the recordings that he made as a conductor of the music of earlier times.
There is a great little piece in the New York Times obituary. It says, as a senior in high school, he was called in to help with Holiday in Mexico, an MGM musical that starred Walter Pidgeon and in which Fidel Castro was an extra. It sounds as if Andre Previn, from a very early age, had a lot of talent, and that talent was recognized. Can you talk about his early career and, you know, when he was recognized as something of a prodigy?
I mean, he was really studying music from a very, very early age. And when they left Berlin to escape the Nazis, they were first in Paris, and then he was in L.A., and through all of that was advancing by leaps and bounds as a performer and, I think, quickly as a composer. And he could just, he was one of these prodigies who could just do anything. And I mean, and that gave a certain sense of him being, I mean, this was a read on Leonard Bernstein as well, that he was a bit of a dilettante, that he could do everything plausibly and often way more so.
Did he find himself in competition with Leonard Bernstein, or was it more that he saw his career trajectory and thought that there was a good model to follow there?
I think that was the sense that I've always had. I mean, I don't know that they were in sort of direct competition, and Bernstein was very New York-based and, I mean, had made his first mark in musical theater and then was doing way more conducting kind of on the European continent, though Previn obviously ended up at the London Symphony early in his career, so they overlapped, but Previn was a creature of Hollywood and, I mean, and located there, and Bernstein was more New York.
I think like a lot of music directors, he occasionally found himself in conflict with people with whom he was working. He had a falling out with Ernest Fleischman at the LA Philharmonic. And I'm wondering if you think back at his legacy in the podium as a conductor, what was he most remembered for and what were his skills leading an orchestra?
Yeah, I mean, my sense, I mean, having never seen him live as a conductor, I mean, I think the sense was he was an excellent musician and had a real kind of taste for the repertoire. I mean, given that he was a composer, I mean, he wasn't sort of famous for fostering new music. And I mean, I think that there was a sense of, certainly in LA, of wanting to broaden the lineup by bringing in Esapekka as a principal guest. And whether or not that was intended to send a signal that it was sort of time for him to go, I don't know. I mean, I think probably politically it was a bit of a mess, but I think that there were certainly things that he was leaving out, or things that, I mean, other emphases that Fleischmann wanted. And but I think that he was always extremely well respected at the podium, and the recordings attest to this. They're extremely vibrant and kind of extremely polished.
So Andre Previn was the music director or principal conductor for about a half dozen orchestras. He composed a variety of film scores, including one for Elmer Gantry. He was a jazz pianist. He wrote operas. Can you think of any contemporary of his living today who could cover such a broad spectrum of musical performance and styles and leadership roles?
I don't think that it exists. I mean, these different strands of music have, in a way, become a little more professionalized over the past couple of decades. And while there's a lot of collaboration between them, people stay, I think, in their lanes a little bit more. I mean, this came up last year when we here at the Times were talking about, it was the centenary of Bernstein's birth, and we were thinking about parallels today and people we might even want to have comment on that. And it is awfully hard to think about people, I mean, of a younger generation who are having that kind of career, but there weren't so many people even in the heyday of Bernstein and Previn. I mean, they were always exceptional.
Zachary Wolf is the classical music editor at the New York Times. Zachary, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking about the life and work of Andre Previn.
Thank you.
And one more note about Andre Previn. The LA Phil commissioned a new work from Previn for its centennial celebration. The orchestra is scheduled to perform its world premiere in October. Coming up on The Frame, Chiwetel Ejiofor writes, directs, and stars in a new movie. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The British actor Chiwetel Ejiofor was so determined to bring the story of William Kamkwamba to the screen that he signed on to write, direct, and star in a movie about him. The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind is Ejiofor's directorial debut. He adapted the script from the memoir of the same name, and in the film he plays William's father, Triwell Kamkwamba. By now, William is a college graduate. He studied at Dartmouth, and you can watch his TED Talks online. But the William in The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind is a 13-year-old. He figures out how to build a wind turbine to bring electricity to his remote village in Malawi. When I visited with Ejiofor last month at the Sundance Film Festival, where his movie premiered, he told me about shooting on location in Malawi and how that country is different from other African nations.
Malawi isn't a resource-rich place, you know, which in some ways is one of the reasons why, as a country and historically as a country, it hasn't been, there was never a hard invasion of Malawi, and it was never split up. It was never separated in the way into communities in the way that, say, the British Empire did in Nigeria, for example, and how empire has operated in places that are more resource rich. So that is a distinction from Malawi, and it gives Malawi a certain characteristic. You know, they've always been at peace. You know, they are by GDP one of the poorest places in the world, but they are often called the kind of warm heart of Africa, because there is a sense of community, a sense of optimism, a sense of togetherness in Malawi, which was one of the reasons why we always felt when we were shooting there that we had the kind of wind at our backs, because the community really rallied around this project. And it really felt very ultra specific that William Kamkwamba came from Malawi, and the ideas of Malawi and the culture and the nature of Malawi is a very specific thing.
At what point do you say, I need to make this movie, this movie needs to be made? What was the process like? Because it did not come together very quickly.
As soon as I read the book in 2009, I think I read it, I was aware that I wanted to make the film.
I didn't know what capacity, not necessarily that I'd be the filmmaker, but I wanted to get this project up and running. I wanted to try and tell this story and to get this story sort of out there. I just thought it was an incredibly layered story and had all sorts of nuances that I just engaged with, as well as its kind of overriding inspirational narrative. I just thought it talked about so many things that, you know, things that were important to me and things that I didn't even know were important to me, you know.
Like what?
Well, there's just the nature, the connection of the cultural experience of Africa, of village life, the community experience of Africa and village life, and that creation through complicated circumstances of extraordinary individuals who do harness and have this amazing potential and potential impact in the world that is muted or nullified or regressed, you know, so immediately by various pitfalls, you know, that are there in terms of education, in terms of sometimes how the family dynamics work, that people sort of struggle against right from inception, right from the beginning. And it was something about William's respectful maneuvering of obstacles that reminded me so intrinsically of a kind of African psychology of a young man in that kind of context, and there was something that I just adored about that.
I think the thing that resonated a lot for me is that there are a lot of poor cities in this country where access to education is a privilege and not a right, and that's an issue for William. He doesn't have, like a lot of his friends, access to great education. You have to pay for it. You may not have money. And yet the fact that there are books and the fact that there's a librarian and the fact that that librarian recognizes his interest and lets him find a book that changes his life is unbelievable. And yet I think that story, we just forget that education changes lives. And if you don't have education, you're often not going to change your own circumstances.
I mean, absolutely. You know, there's a moment in the book, and I think it was if I could pinpoint the moment where I was completely sold, that I just was like, I have to try and tell this story, was actually a description of William Kamkwamba sneaking into school. You know, he's been thrown out because his parents can't afford the fees. He wants to get back into school. He wants to learn. And so he sneaks into school during a break, you know, a sort of lunch break or a recess, and sneaks back in with the rest of the students. And it just, you know, I just sort of put down the book at that point and just thought, you know, what was I doing at 13? What was my relationship to school when I was 13 years old? Is it conceivable that I would be sneaking into a school? You know, I'd be sneaking into a maths class or a science class. Or, I mean, it's just inconceivable. It's just absolutely. And I just thought, and that distinction, that separation, you know, that privilege, you know, was just something that really struck me as an important thing to highlight, to think about.
Mr. Kachigunde.
Mr. Skelo. This is William Kamkwamba. He's part of my science class. He's no longer a student here, but he and I have been working on various experiments, and I'd like for him to continue his studies here in the library.
Does Mr. Ofesi know about this?
Of course. Mr. Ofesi's only stipulation is the boy is not to be taught or assisted by you or any other teacher. It's important to him that the boy working here is not common knowledge. He himself would prefer not to be reminded of the fact.
Of course.
We're talking with Chiwetel Ejiofor about his movie, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. There's another moment in this film that is very meaningful to a lot of people who are parents, and you play William's father in the film, and that is when William recognizes, and maybe his father doesn't yet, that William's smarter than his dad.
Totally. You know, there's that sense of that, just that generational shift, you know, that Triwell is stuck in a world that is changing, stuck in a world that is moving on, stuck in a world where the things and the principles that he has been taught no longer work. And that is, I think, the thing about this kind of evolving crisis that we're all facing, that we're all in, is that some of the things that we have been taught that work, that are the way things have been done, no longer apply to this changing world and a changing landscape. And for Triwell, like so many other people in the world, you know, that leap, that understanding of how to change himself in order to adapt to the new circumstances is actually too much of a struggle. It's too beyond him. to replace himself as the kind of patriarch, as the person who's going to solve all of the issues, the person who's going to resolve all the crisis. And in the end, you know, he has to come to the realization that there is another generation and they are going to be the ones who are going to solve it, and he has to assist them.
At what point did you say, I'm the best person to write this?
I mean, that's a good question. I don't know if I ever said I'm the best person to write
it. How about, I need to write this, or I'm going to write this?
I think that the thing was, I didn't know if it was going to be something that would just get made, sort of organically on its own, without any intervention from me, you know. I suppose that was in the back of my mind, that sense of, I guess if I don't do this, it might not happen. And that began the process for me. I'd sort of written a few pieces, not really with the aim of really developing them, but wanting to just sort of investigate writing screenplays. But this was one that I just thought, right, this is the point that I'll have to really dive into this and to really try and get underneath it, because I feel this is the best way of getting this film made.
And if I had come to visit your set in Malawi, what would I notice that would be different and that you would be proud of people seeing?
Well, I just think that one of the things that we had, which I really found incredibly special, was this just extraordinarily international group of people coming together to tell the story of this young boy in Malawi. You know, I began the process sort of immediately talking to Tule Peak in Brazil, who had made a film, City of God, as the production designer. I'd loved the whole film, but I'd loved the production design of City of God. And so I spoke to him in Brazil. I sent him the script. He flew over to Malawi. He brought with him Bia Salgado, who did the costume design for the film. She'd also worked on City of God. Then the Italian editor, Valerio Bonelli, who I'd met in London, who, when he was working with Joe Wright, flew over. And then Dick Pope flew over from London. You know, he'd finished doing Peterloo with Mike Lee.
He's your cinematographer.
He's the cinematographer. You know, with Dick, the South Africans arrived, you know, and they all came up from Joburg and Cape Town as the assistant camera department, the grips, everybody. And then we started to get people in from Nairobi, Kenya. And so this group started to emerge, and we all stayed at the Chico Hotel, which is this, you know, this hotel in the outskirts of Kasungu, which is itself on the outskirts of Malawi, which, you know, and we were all in there, and it was just this international crowd with Malawians working in all of the departments, you know, who were incredibly excited about learning about the film business. It hadn't been a film of this kind of scale, or anywhere near this kind of scale in Malawi, really. So you being on the set, if you walked onto the set, that's the thing I think that would strike you, is all of this sort of range of personnel and people and international feeling.
Chiwetel, great to see you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Pleasure, thank you.
Chiwetel Ejiofor wrote and directed The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. He also co-stars in the film. It's available on Netflix and in select theaters on March 1st. Coming up on The Frame, students from Van Nuys High School revisit a pivotal moment in L.A. history with help from the L.A. Master Chorale. Today is Thursday, and that's the day our weekly newsletter goes out. It's perfect one-stop shopping to stay up to date with our show and with headlines from the wide world of culture. And we always include tips for events happening in Southern California over the coming weekend. You can sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. But now, let's go back in time. In March of 1968, a little more than 50 years ago, thousands of students from five high schools in East L.A. walked out of their classrooms. They were protesting the unequal education that they were receiving. Until last year's nationwide protest by students concerned about school shootings, L.A.'s walkouts were considered the biggest such event in U.S. history. This weekend, students from Van Nuys High School will revisit that historical event in an oratorio they wrote with artists from the L.A. Master Chorale. KPCC Arts Education reporter Carla Javier has this preview.
It's production week, and students from Van Nuys High are practicing the opening movement from a show that is titled Walkout, Past, Present, Repeat. It isn't your typical high school musical. For one thing, it's an oratorio, as senior Darian Calderon puts it.
It's less rhymey and less like show tuney than a musical is.
So imagine fewer sets and costumes, more choral music. Oh, and another thing that makes this one special.
The students are used to singing music that's put in front of them.
That's LA Master Chorale's Leslie Beard, the producer of the project.
But to sing music that they wrote, it's such a unique experience for them.
That's right. The students wrote this 40-minute work with help from teaching artists. The process took 20 weeks. They did research, wrote personal essays, and interviewed participants of the history they're portraying on stage. That informed the lyrics. Next came the music. Here's the school's choir director, Brianne Arevalo.
We talk about word painting so that we make the music really sound like what the words are.
Like that opening song.
Walk out, walk out, walk out, walk. It's so percussive, and yet their voices are behind all of this percussion, so it imitates this whole movement of marching through, being strong together.
One of the movements is written from the point of view of one of the real-life student organizers of the walkouts, Paula Crisostomo.
We got very emotional today, like every time we sang Movement 2, because Movement 2 is about a girl feeling that students deserve better.
In the song, the girl's teacher has been disrespecting her, so she tells him that she'll become a teacher one day and help her students.
Hear Jessica sing that. I feel like she's really expressing what many young teachers go into this field for, that the students deserve more and deserve to be heard.
Arevalo, who has taught in LAUSD for 12 years, believes studying history through music helps the students understand the events and the people behind them in a different way.
It's not just reading it in a book or casually talking about it in discussion, but they are the characters, and you can hear that through their singing, through their performance, through the look in their eyes, even when they're not singing, that they've really embodied the message of what they have learned.
Student Darian Calderon plays Sal Castro, a teacher and key organizer of the 1968 walkouts.
I read about him and I saw interviews with him, and the thing that struck me the most and the thing that I want to portray the most is that he cared so much for his students. He didn't let anything get in the way with that. He lost his job because of his students, and he kept on fighting all for his students.
Stand together, brothers and sisters. You are not alone. As they try to tear us down, we will fight for our rights and unify the Chicanos.
After watching and reading and learning so much about this entire movement, I'm honestly a little disappointed in myself that I didn't know a lot about the movement and Sal Castro, but I am so grateful that I do now.
Though it's not just the past that the students are learning about.
In the later part of the oratorio, we do discuss more current events, and we do discuss the Parkland shooting.
And the surge of student activism that's happened since.
I never thought that working on a piece that involves the Chicano movements can talk about something so recent.
Teaching artist Alice Kerwin Murray says she can't help but notice how these projects keep relating to current events.
2 years ago, we did the Japanese-American internment, and it happened to coincide with the Muslim travel ban. Last year, the topic was the history of the women's movement, and it was right before Me Too showed up in everybody's consciousness.
For choir director Brianne Arevalo, it's not just about what the students learned about history, current events, or even about themselves, but also what the audience can learn from them.
This oratorio is composed of 80 students who all have different thoughts and feelings and ideas, and they debated, and they disagreed, and they didn't crumble under disagreement. And I think that's a great demonstration for not just other students, but lots of people in this world. These students are an amazing example for everyone.
That story was produced by KPCC's arts education reporter, Carla Javier. Walkout Past, Present, Repeat with students from Van Nuys High School and members of the LA Master Chorale will be performed at Van Nuys High School on Saturday at 1 p.m. The performance is free and open to the public. And that's our show for today. Remember, you can always get The Frame as a podcast, and that way you'll never miss a single episode of the show. You'll find us on iTunes and Stitcher or wherever you like to listen. I'm John Horn. Thanks for tuning in. We're back here tomorrow.